There we go. All right. Good afternoon, everyone. I am honored to moderate this final panel of this year's National Student Symposium. I want to thank the Federal Society for inviting me and for putting on another wonderful annual event. This panel has been asked to address one simple question. Is judicial review democratic? Now, a cynic might say, well, sure, judicial review is democratic when I like the result. It's anti-democratic when I don't like the result. So the question is there a principled response to the cynic? If your views on the role of the judiciary and the importance of deferring to the legislature changes depending on whether we're talking about a case like, say, Dobbs or a case like, say, Bruin, then you either have a principled theory or you don't. Today, we have a nationally acclaimed panel of scholars to help us decide whether there is indeed a principled rather than cynical answer to our question. I'm going to introduce each of them briefly so that we can jump right into their discussion. We'll hear first from Keith Whittington. He is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Politics at Princeton University. He's also the founding chair of the American Freedom Alliance. He's the author of Repugnant Laws, Judicial Review of Acts of Congress from the Founding to the President to the Present, as well as Political Foundations of Judicial Supremacy, the Presidency, the Supreme Court, and Constitutional Leadership in U.S. History. And he served recently as a member of the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States, a bipartisan commission created by the President to examine proposals for Supreme Court reform. Next, we'll hear from Tara Grove. She is the Vinson and Elkins Chair in Law here at home at the University of Texas School of Law. She previously served at the U.S. Department of Justice as a member of the prestigious Civil Division's appellate staff. Her research interests focus on the federal judiciary, interpretive theory, and separation of powers. She's a co-author of Federal Courts and the Law of Federal-State Relations, and she's also served on the President's Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States. Finally, we're delighted to have Lawrence Sager. He holds the Alice Jane Drysdale Sheffield Regents Chair, that's a mouthful, also right here at the University of Texas School of Law. He's the author of two books, Justice in Plain Clothes, A Theory of American Constitutional Practice, and Religion, Religious Freedom and the Constitution. He is, like all of our panelists, one of the nation's leading constitutional theorists and scholars. Professor Whittington, would you like to kick us off?
All right, so thank you very much. Appreciate y'all being here. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak on this very fine panel. It's a very Texas-heavy panel, but in an ideal world, all panels would be very Texas-heavy. I should note that Judge Ho did not mention that I am also an alum of this great institution, as well as a native of the state. So it's always nice to get back to Austin. So I see my job here is partially table setting, trying to get some issues and concepts on the table, as well as introduce some empirical issues about how we ought to think about how the court actually behaves and what the implications of that might be for normative theory and thinking about how it fits into a democratic system more generally. So the basic normative problem, of course, is a familiar one and a fairly old one, really dates from the populace in the into the 19th century and the progressives in the early 20th century, but was given a name famously by Alexander Bickel in the mid-20th century, of thinking that there's a fundamental normative puzzle about the court, and that is the so-called counter-majoritarian difficulty, that the court is an anti-democratic institution that imposes its will on more democratic institutions, primarily legislatures, that get their authority from having been elected by the people. Depending on your perspective, this is either a very deep problem about the court or potentially it's a feature of the court. And you certainly have had people across American history who have argued, yes, the court is anti-democratic and that's a good thing to boot. And that was partially what the populists and progressives were responding to in part, were people who made that kind of argument. That raises, though, a kind of question that's occupied a fair amount of normative academic theory, especially in the latter part of the 20th century. It's calmed down some, I think, more recently, although probably is about to get some renewed attention from parts of academia, of how do you justify the court of this nature? What are the kinds of problems that it raises, and what are the implications then for what the court ought to do, given this kind of counter-majoritarian feature to it? And there are three sort of basic kinds of arguments that have been laid out that would justify some continuing practice of judicial review, given this democratic concern. One is the court ought to limit itself to behaving in ways that reinforce how democracy operates. So rather than acting in a counter-majoritarian and democratic fashion, the court ought to stick to occasions when it can make democracy work better. And this is most closely associated with John Hart Ely, but in some form or another is embraced by a fair number of theorists, including some of the justices over time. An alternative is to think that the court should in fact trump democracy, that there are just some values and interests that are more important than democracy, and so it's perfectly fine to have a court that represents those kinds of interests. I think this is associated more recently by Ronald Dworkin and his theorizing. I think this is a strong feature of the common good constitutionalist movement in general, that just wants to identify something other than democracy that we think is important and see the court as an institution that can promote that other important thing. And then the third kind of argument, I think, is a much more traditional kind of argument, but it's an argument that I've made, that Bruce Ackerman makes, that was also associated with some of the founders and John Marshall as well, which is the court, too, appeals to a kind of democratic authority when it exercises its power, which is to say that it tries to give a voice and effect to a fundamental law that people themselves have authorized and endorsed in the form of the Constitution. So when the court is striking down something that a legislature has done, it's acting against a lesser democratic authority on behalf of a more important and more fundamental democratic authority represented in the Constitution, per se. So like I said, there are various answers to this kind of counter-majoritarian problem. Counter-majoritarian problem has sort of been taken for granted as a very important problem, and normatively speaking, that we ought to try to grapple with about how the court exercises judicial review. I want to spend the rest of the few minutes I have, though, to ask, is this really a problem at all in an empirical sense, and should we really worry about this very much? I sort of took for granted the significance of the counter-majoritarian problem when I was beginning my academic career. I mostly took on board the counter-majoritarian problem as a way of describing the issues associated with the court and the kind of normative puzzles that need to be solved. More recently, which is, say, over the last 10 years or so, in part as a consequence of more empirical work that I've done and others have done, I've become much more skeptical about whether the counter-majoritarian difficulty really describes a very important problem that we need to worry very much about. For me, that means that partially what our concerns ought to be about how the court fits into a democracy have shifted a little bit into thinking maybe some other features of the court and how it behaves ought to be more important to us than the counter-majoritarian difficulty per se, and also suggest maybe we don't have to worry as much about the counter-majoritarian difficulty as I once thought. So there's multiple ways of getting to that kind of deflation of the counter-majoritarian concern. One kind of approach, which I associate particularly with Robert Dahl, but certainly there have been others, emphasizes the court as a kind of coalition partner with other political actors and government more generally. So rather than thinking about the court as simply standing outside of politics and then imposing its will on the political system, we should instead understand the court as part of the political system more generally, constituted through politics broadly, and as a consequence works in some cooperation with other political officials more generally. A second kind of concern about how real this problem is might be framed as Mark Graber, who was once on the faculty here in the political science department, now is at University of Maryland, characterized it as the non-majoritarian difficulty, which is to say, often in practice, our politics in a democratic society is composed of very divided coalitions in which there's not much of a majority will behind anything in particular. And so we're often making decisions based on log rolls, based on compromises, based on coalitions that get formed in which people are willing to go along with something even though they don't care very much about it. And so as a consequence, when the court intervenes, It often is not operating against any kind of settled majority sentiment, either in legislatures or in the populace more generally. Instead, it is acting against what is itself a minority position that has made its way into statutes. And then finally, there are arguments about public opinion in the court, which is argues that, and here I think the empirical evidence is a bit mixed as to how true this is, that the court often is not very far out of whack from public opinion more generally. So what we care about is not necessarily how the court relates to democratically elected politicians, but instead how the court relates to public opinion. We ought to be concerned then about to what degree does the court actually oppose majority sentiment and how often and under what circumstances. And there's some evidence at least that suggests that the court often is not too far away from majority public opinion in general. And if that's what really what we're worried about, maybe we shouldn't worry so much. But need a drink of water. Finally, I was just going to say, and then I do want to wrap up. The part of the project I was concerned with the repugnant laws was trying to catalog all the instances in which the Supreme Court, in particular, evaluated the constitutionality of a federal statute or provision of a federal statute through the course of American history. Took much longer and was more work than I intended when I started that project. But among the interesting things that I think emerges out of it is the finding that really when the court exercises power of judicial review relative to federal laws at least, what it mostly is doing is upholding federal statutes rather than striking them down. The striking down statutes something that occurs occasionally, but far more often what the court is doing is empowering Congress, explaining why it is Congress has the authority to do what it's doing against those who might object. And as Brutus told us during the ratification debates, we might anticipate then what a national Supreme Court would really be doing is centralizing power in the national government per se by authorizing the federal government to do more stuff. And that's in fact what the court has often done across its history. In addition, what we might think of as the most counter-majoritarian kinds of decisions the court makes, which is it's striking down laws that are relatively recently adopted, striking down important laws people actually care about, including those who adopted them in the first place, and they're striking down laws that were favored by the political opposition, so a relatively conservative court striking down relatively liberal laws, for example. This is really only about 5% of the total number of cases in which the court has struck down laws. These are important instances, these are important occasions in which the court has exercised the power of judicial review, but this is not the dominant pattern, this is not what the court's doing most of the time. So what we're really concerned about is how judicial review works in general. If that's our ideal model as to what we have in mind when we think about the normative puzzle surrounding the court, that's describing a very small feature of what the court is doing. Most of what the court's doing is something else, and we need to get a better handle on both the empirics of that, but also potentially what the normative implications of other things might in fact be. Notably, that includes the fact that the court often is striking down laws that are being adopted by what we might think of as their coalition partners, the people who are ideologically and politically aligned with the court. That is, conservative courts strike down laws passed by conservatives at roughly a comparable rate as to how often they strike down laws passed by liberals, and liberal courts tend to do the same thing. So if there's a counter-majoritarian difficulty we're worried about, there's normative difficulties we want to worry about, it probably is something a little different than what the populists have in mind or what Alexander Bickel has in mind. And I think there are some real normative challenges here that we ought to think through once we focus on what the court actually does. One is we might be concerned about elite preferences. As the court represents a particular set of elite values, it's often imposing against things that are more popular. And so the court tends to go along with mainstream opinion as is reflected in relatively elite cultural and political circles, but maybe not so much elsewhere in the political system more generally. So how much should we worry about that kind of power that's being exercised by a relatively elitist institution? Secondly, a court exercising this kind of power allows for some blame avoidance by politicians. As part of what the courts do is clean up messes that politicians make, which allows politicians to demagogue on very popular issues, say they're doing all these very popular things, and then casting the blame to the courts when those things actually get struck down over time. We might think this is not a very good way of running a democracy. More generally, maybe there's some problems with allowing politicians off the hook in this way, but it's a bit of a challenge. Third, there's a question about nationalization. Part of what the court is doing over the course of its history is empowering the federal government and imposing restrictions on the states, in particular. And so this nationalizing function of the Supreme Court doesn't fit neatly into the normative puzzle set up by counter-majoritarianism, but potentially does create real normative issues. And fourth, the court can short-circuit constitutional politics more generally. That is, political arguments that are taking place in the political arena more generally, including in elected arenas like the executive and legislature, may well be dealing with constitutional issues, working through constitutional issues, debating about these constitutional issues, and judicial interventions can short-circuit that process, fix a solution in time, and cut off the ability of other political actors to continue thinking about the problem in significant ways. And we may think that that's deleterious to our political system more generally. So I'll end up there. So I just want to highlight that there is a genuine set of normative puzzles surrounding the court and how it relates to democracy, but that may not be very well captured by the traditional kind of concerns as we often think about this.
So thanks so much. It's lovely to be here. Thank you guys for coming to Austin. It's always nice when conferences come to me and I don't have to go to the conferences. So it's great to see all of you here. So I'm going to be talking about kind of the flip side of what Professor Whittington was talking about. He was talking about how the judiciary acts, and I'm going to say a lot more about political actors and the political branches. So when Alexander Bickle talked about the counter-majoritarian difficulty, or when people heard him talking about the counter-majoritarian difficulty, the assumption was that judges could be anti-democratic. That is, judges could issue decisions that people didn't like, whether or not they did. And what I want to suggest to you is that's very much historically contingent in our society. The ability of judges to truly exercise judicial independence such that they might do things other folks don't like. For much of our history, the federal judiciary did not have that kind of independence. So today, we hear debates about student loans, about redistricting. When we hear debates about the independent state legislature doctrine, people wonder, what is the Supreme Court going to do? And nobody asks the separate question of, will anyone care? But this was a real question for much of our society. Judicial independence, I want to suggest to you, is a highly contingent feature of our system. Now, what do I mean by judicial independence? So many of us, if we read the Constitution, we see that Article III judges enjoy tenure and salary protections. They serve during good behavior. Their salaries can't be cut. So you get a job for life. Your salary can't be cut. It's a good gig, right? Well, is that really where judicial independence comes from? What I wouldn't suggest is it's a lot more complicated than that. It also matters that Congress isn't just going to take away federal jurisdiction. It also matters that Congress is not going to expand the size of the Supreme Court. It matters that Congress isn't going to cut judgeship positions. It matters that Congress is only going to try to remove federal judges through the impeachment power rather than obliterating federal courts, which, by the way, was done in our history and was considered to be maybe on the table until the early 20th century. When things are off the table, the idea that actually, Congress probably won't cut federal jurisdiction. Congress will not pack the Supreme Court. Congress will only remove federal judges through impeachment, and that the executive branch will actually obey court decisions. These are norms of judicial independence that have developed over time, and actually, I want to suggest to you, pretty recently. So let me take the norm that is probably the most important for the federal judiciary and the least talked about, compliance with federal court orders. Throughout much of our history, political actors have refused to comply with federal court orders, at least some of the time, even Supreme Court decisions. This only started to change according to my research, historically, in the mid to late 20th century. So after Brown versus the Board of Education, there was, as you probably know from history, massive resistance to that decision and tremendous, tremendous resistance to desegregation. Now, when I studied this period of history and looked at the resistance to Brown, what I expected to find was the following. many segregationists saying we like segregation, but you kind of have to follow federal court decisions saying that you have to integrate. That's what I expected to find. That is not what I found. What I found was segregationists not only saying that they liked segregation, but also saying that it was okay to disobey federal court desegregation orders. So for example, Senator James Eastland from the state of Mississippi said on the Senate floor, when he was talking about Governor Ross Barnett of Mississippi disobeying a federal court order, Senator James Eastland said, Governor Barnett has, quote, courageously and boldly pressed himself forward both as a governor and as an individual and obstructed an order of a U.S. court, end quote, on the Senate floor. So how do we get our current convention that everybody's going to obey the Supreme Court? I argue that it came after Brown versus Board of Education, and in part because of this massive resistance. Over time, disobeying a federal court order became equated with resistance to Brown versus the Board of Education. And as Brown itself became canonical, disobeying federal court orders became a real problem. What about court packing? Well, President Roosevelt sure tried it in 1937, and a lot of people think, well, in 1937, Roosevelt proposed this thing, and everybody said, oh, that's crazy, nobody should ever do that, and the public just hated it, and the Congress voted it down. That's actually not how things worked. There was a tremendous amount of support for President Roosevelt's court packing plan in 1937, both in Congress and in the public. And many people believe that there was a very good chance that Roosevelt would have added at least 4, if not 6, members of the U.S. Supreme Court had the Supreme Court not started to change its decision-making in the spring of 1937. So when did court packing become kind of off the wall? Well, according to my research, it was largely starting in the 1950s. People treated court packing as a political epithet. If you didn't like something that was happening, either a proposal to reform the judiciary or a particular nominee, you would say that the president was trying to pack the Supreme Court. Somebody named Joseph Biden said that when he was in the US Senate, when Reagan nominated Robert Bork to the Supreme Court, Biden said, the president is trying to pack the Supreme Court with conservatives. And over time, it became a political epithet used by both Democrats and Republicans. Until recently. And court packing is a good example of how contingent judicial independence is. Because starting in 2018, and really not before, I want to say to you, starting in 2018, people started to use court packing not just as a political epithet, but as something that we ought to do. Now, as Judge Ho said, both Professor Whittington and I served on President Biden's Supreme Court Commission, which was considering a variety of reforms, considered proposals to take away the jurisdiction of the federal judiciary, proposals to get rid of life tenure and impose term limits at least on the U.S. Supreme Court, proposals to create supermajority requirements for the Supreme Court such that it could not strike down federal laws unless there was at least a 6 or 7-person supermajority, proposals talking about the shadow docket, and proposals to expand the United States Supreme Court. Now, whatever you think of court expansion or court packing, and by the way, people use different terms depending on what they think of it, whatever you think of it, the fact that we are talking about it at all is an extraordinary point in the Supreme Court's history. Nobody before 2016, 2017, even proposed court packing, and almost nobody until 2018 started to take it seriously, and this is part of our political debate. When court packing is actually part of your political debate, the decisional independence of the federal judiciary, that is, the ability of federal judges to issue decisions without fear of attack from the political branches, is considerably hindered. So then what do you do? So there's a question for the Supreme Court itself. If you're worried about your legitimacy, and they are, if you're worried about your legitimacy, what do you do? And how do I think that they are? So both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kagan, two justices who do not talk about this kind of stuff very often, talked about Supreme Court legitimacy. Now, Chief Justice Roberts said you shouldn't be worried about Supreme Court legitimacy. I feel pretty confident he wouldn't have given a speech about Supreme Court legitimacy if you were not worried about the Supreme Court's legitimacy. And I feel pretty confident that Justice Kagan would not have responded to Chief Justice Roberts' comments if she was not aware that the court is actually worried about its legitimacy. Well, there are different ways to respond. You could take the approach of the 1937 court, or at least what some people think was the approach of the 1937 court, and start to change your decisions. And I think that's actually what a lot of people are talking about right now. This creates what I've called a legitimacy dilemma. Would the court potentially compromise the legal legitimacy of its decisions, that is what it thinks it should be doing, out of concern for the sociological legitimacy of the court as a whole, that is what the public thinks of it? These are very, very difficult questions for the court and difficult questions for the political branches, because the more these court reforms are talked about, the less judicial independence the federal judiciary actually has. Now, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is something that very much depends on the person. But then this leads me back to Bickel. The counter-majoritarian difficulty is also often cited as this notion that the judiciary can do whatever it wants, and that can be problematic for majorities. That's actually not what Bickel thought, nor is it what he said. When he was writing in the post-Brown era, he was well aware of massive resistance and the fact that people might not actually listen to the court. In fact, Professor Bickel was all in favor of Brown II and the all deliberate speed formula. For those of you who are taking constitutional law right now, you'll learn about it. If you're taking it from me, we'll learn about it in a couple weeks. But let me fill you in. The all deliberate speed formula said, you know, we should have desegregation, but, you know, kind of at your own pace, people. And it was probably one of the most deplorable decisions in Supreme Court history because it delayed desegregation in embarrassing ways. But Bickel thought it was a really good idea because he saw how very fragile the independence of the Supreme Court was in the 1950s and 1960s. And so this is the point that I want to make to you. If you want a counter-majoritarian court, or frankly, even a court that can exercise judicial review, it is not enough to envision what the Supreme Court should do. It is crucially contingent on what the political branches do with respect to the court. And I'll stop there.
So I'm very glad to be here for a lot of reasons. It's wonderful to be on a panel with three people whom I admire and like, as I find myself. It's wonderful to be at a conference where I can feel really proud of the students of the University of Texas School of Law, as I am. Which means that what I'm going to do might be a mistake, because I've got 15 minutes, and I want to introduce a fairly complex idea in that short time. And it's an idea which might lead to outcomes that some folks on the panel or out there may not like. But I have a kind of remarkable privilege. I'm not sure I've had it before. I'm the last panelist of the whole conference. So if things go really wrong, you know, we'll all survive. So I'd like you to...
Well, Governor Abbott can always veto you.
Right, exactly. So I'd like you to be patient, because this idea starts in a strange place. I want to introduce the idea of an imperfect moral duty. Now, what an imperfect moral duty is just this. It is a binding, serious, critical moral duty but one which involves a great deal of judgment and discretion in its discharge. The best example of that, the easiest example, which will come back to courts and democracy eventually, is the obligation of parents to keep their children safe and help them to flourish. A hugely important moral duty, but a duty about which parents have a tremendous amount of discretion and judgment. Not an infinite amount. There are things that parents must do. There are things that parents can't do. But there's a very broad area where parents, while morally burdened, can make many choices. One way to think about this, and this will sort of set us up for the constitutional point I want to make, is the following. It's very common to think of moral duties and legal duties as having a firm categorical core, but then when you get out to the periphery, discretion and judgment sets in. The famous example that some of you know is the statute that prohibits vehicles in the park. And we know it means you can't drive a car through the park, but as we get further away from that, things get more discretionary and judgment bound. The interesting thing about imperfect moral duties and their legal equivalent, as I'll describe, is that that model is reversed. In an imperfect moral duty, the center or core is discretionary and judgment bound, and only at the periphery do you get into categorical insistences. So parents have very serious categorical rules, but it's at the periphery of their behavior. Okay. Now, the proposition I want to set on the table is that there are important constitutional provisions that constitute imperfect constitutional duties, and that, like parenting, these constitutional provisions call for the achievement of elusive but morally crucial states of affairs with competing strategies about how to get there. And only at the extremes of misbehavior do these constitutional provisions carry categorical commands. This matters, this idea. It's not just an idle comparison. It matters because what I want to suggest at the bottom of all this is courts' role with regard to these constitutional provisions is at the categorical periphery. And legislatures occupy a democratic privilege of strategic choice in the discretionary core. So it matters if constitutional rights have this, or claims have this structure, and it matters which is which for the problem that the panel has taken on. Now, I'm going to offer a surprising example of this, and that's the Equal Protection Clause. I want to argue that the Equal Protection Clause sets forth an imperfect constitutional duty. Now, I'm going to say some words about what I think the Equal Protection Clause means. And we can quarrel about that later. But these aren't particularly artful or subtle. They may even seem familiar. I think the Equal Protection Clause says all members of our political community are entitled to be regarded as equal in status and stature, to equal concern and respect. Securing that state of affairs is a project to which the government should be committed. Okay, that's what I think the Equal Protection Clause stands for. Or to put it differently, the Equal Protection Clause, above all, sets itself against there being groups in our society that are victims of structural injustice. Many of you know what that phrase means. I don't want it to be very artful. It's the idea that they are victims of enduring patterns of disrespect and discrimination, patterns that are pervasive, enduring, and tentacular, if you don't mind me getting florid at the end of that. So on my account, the Equal Protection Clause, above all, despises structural injustice, and much of our equal protection jurisprudence reflects that. Now, at the extreme margins of this obligation of states, we have recognizable judicially enforced doctrine that I don't mean to call into question, so that the court has and does react immediately if the state directly discriminates against the victims of structural injustice. Much of our jurisprudence is aligned at that project. And actually, that categorical periphery is pretty thick. So it's not just that the state can't discriminate, the state can't do things which facilitate and encourage its citizens to discriminate. So that Justice Harlan's famous dissent in Plessy versus Ferguson, when he said that the Louisiana statute only had one meaning, meant that there was a social meaning of the despised nature of African Americans in American society. And that, for Harlan, was the essence of what was wrong, that the state was setting a proposition forward to private citizens to hold other private citizens in a state of disrespect and to discriminate against them. For many people, the best rationale of Brown versus Board of Education is exactly the same thing, that no matter how equal you made facilities, if the state insisted that blacks and whites couldn't study together, that could only be understood by the white majority as the nature of black Americans such that they shouldn't be sitting in the same classroom. That's many, many persons' best view of Brown. And Brown actually rejects Plessy, finally turns on Plessy in Brown. Okay. So at the margins of equal protection, the state can't discriminate and it can't encourage its citizens to discriminate. There are some interesting cases that should have been hard but weren't. For example, when Florida, I think it was Florida, insisted that candidates for office put their race on their ballot. Florida wasn't discriminating, but Florida was inviting its citizens to discriminate and facilitating it, and the Supreme Court had no trouble striking that down. Okay. Now, the question, though, that takes us away from the categorical periphery and into the discretionary core is, what is the nature of the obligation of the state to act affirmatively to ameliorate structural injustice? The state is, in two senses, liable for structural injustice. First of all, the state, with sweeping regimes of law, underwrote structural injustice against blacks, the entire history of slavery, against women, the regimes of law that denied women various opportunities and made them vulnerable to the predations of their husbands, against members of the LGBTQ community with regimes of law that in some sense outlawed them inside their own body. The state's hands are all over structural injustice. And I want to suggest the state isn't only responsible in a causal or historical sense, but is responsible for the liability of a state of affairs that defies constitutional value as structural injustice does. The state is obliged to provide equal protection of the laws and affirmative obligation. But now the question is, and this is the proposition I want to set forward, is who should be in charge of decisions in that middle ground of discretion and judgment, the affirmative amelioration of structural injustice? And there I want to suggest we get to a classic affirmative, imperfect constitutional duty, where there are very difficult questions of strategy and very difficult trade-offs to be made, and where the court should therefore welcome the cooperation of federal, state, and local legislative and executive entities as partners in addressing structural injustice, and where I want to insist the state should defer broadly to those entities with regard to the project of ameliorating structural injustice. And if they don't, I think that they are usurping an important democratic prerogative of these entities, and that we have a clash of federal constitutional power by courts and democratic capacities and obligations to ameliorate structural injustice. Now, not so long ago, there were some cases very sympathetic with what I've just said. And I'll name those for those of you who know these. Katzenbach versus Morgan. The 13th Amendment case, Jones versus Alfred Mayer. Cases in which the court recognized that its judgment about the affirmative obligations to ameliorate structural injustice was not only not the exclusive judgment, but that it owed Congress and states and local governments deference. Those cases have gone by the boards at this point. Katzenbach versus Morgan has given on to a regime of the courts insisting that its view about the content of equal protection is decisive and final. The Voting Rights Act decisions, which have taken a big bite out of the Voting Rights Act and threatened to take even a bigger bite out of the Voting Rights Act. A case called Morrison versus United States, in which the court declined to accept Congress's judgment about the stature of women in the society and their vulnerability to violence and their entitlement to, therefore, a federal cause of action under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. All the court's deference over this project of ameliorating structural injustice has gone completely out of the window. And I think it is not only to the detriment of equal protection, I think it raises serious problems of democratic legitimacy, that the court in this context is exercising judicial review in violation of the dictates of democracy. And I'm going to give you, I sort of threatened to stir things up. I don't think I've done that. So I want to give you a final example of where this line of thought should take us. This is just a small piece of the Constitution. We could talk elsewhere. And that's affirmative action in higher education. I think the best way to understand Justice O'Connor's commitment to educational diversity in the Grutter case is to understand it as really conceding to academic institutions under the authority of their state governments the ability to address structural injustice with responsible and moderate affirmative action programs. Fisher took a step back from that, but only a small one, in part because in the early stages it was argued brilliantly by Judge Ho, who was then in the Solicitor General's office of the state. And there was not a lot of space for independent judgment about the burden of ameliorating structural injustice, but genuine space. No surprise that most people are betting that the court will close that space down. I think that's an example not just of an equal protection mistake, which it may or may not be, but of a democratic mistake. There's nothing simple about affirmative action. Justice Thomas's worry that people just like him are undermined by affirmative action is not trivial. The concern that by maintaining race consciousness, one maintains race consciousness in ways that are detrimental, not a trivial strategic judgment. But strategic judgments about how to ameliorate structural injustice, and no one can think that we have eliminated structural injustice with regard to Black Americans. Strategic judgments like that do not belong to the court. They are in the discretionary core of democratic judgment and obligation. So I think there's a democratic problem lurking in the court's imminent decision to eliminate affirmative action, flowing from the line of argument that I've tried to drag you along through. You've all been very patient. Thank you very much.
So I'd like to eventually invite members of the audience to have this opportunity to raise questions about any of these issues or perhaps other issues relevant to the question before us. But first, I want to see if any of the panelists want to engage with each other and respond to anything. Please.
I think there's an interesting conflict between Professor Whittington's comments and Professor Sager's comments. So Professor Whittington said, you know, usually when the Supreme Court is exercising judicial review of congressional statutes, it's upholding them and allowing congressional power. And Professor Sager is highlighting at least a very important subset of those cases involving Section 5 of the 14th Amendment and to some degree Section 2 of the 15th Amendment, where Congress is trying to effectuate equal protection provisions, possibly the due process provisions of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. And the court is striking down that ability. So I think we could name City of Bernie, we could name United States versus Morrison, as Professor Sager did. There are a series of cases like that. And please explain.
Well, I didn't say there weren't any cases. Oops. Sitting on. I didn't say there weren't any cases. There are some cases. They're a relatively small set, but they're often highly politically salient. We might think that they're growing, and we ought to worry about them more. I'm actually not entirely sure I'd put all the Section 5 cases in that category, but there are some Section 5 cases in that category. I would just also note, I really liked Professor Sager's introduction of this idea of imperfect constitutional duties here, which I find quite intriguing generally. And moreover, I think it's a subset of some other things. And let me just put into different kind of conceptual language that I think reinforces the kinds of concerns he lays out, but also may highlight some aspects of it. So one way I think of thinking some about these imperfect constitutional duties is what Larry Solem characterizes as the construction zone. That is to say, in originalist constitutional theory, there are those of us who've argued that we ought to distinguish between interpretation, instances in which there's some determinacy to the constitutional text and we can identify fairly clear answers, and areas in which there's a great deal of indeterminacy about what the constitutional answers ought to be in that context. And moreover, I've argued that in the construction zone, courts ought to be relatively deferential to other political actors in fleshing out what the right answer is in a context in which the Constitution itself is not very determinant in that context. And we might think that these imperfect constitutional duties and maybe the Equal Protection Clause in particular is an example of operating in this kind of construction zone in which we think the court ought to be defining what the outer ranges are, but shouldn't necessarily get too involved in what's happening in the indeterminate core. I would note that there's still, even in that context, potential disagreements about what that core looks like when you've hit the outer limits, and so it's entirely possible that you might disagree with Professor Sager about whether or not you've actually bumped up against the outer limit in some of these cases. Depends on what you think the content of the 14th Amendment is in that context. The second thing I would emphasize is, or frame this about, is part of what we get now is a convergence between judicial supremacy and efforts at constitutional interpretation, and where the court is has a very robust understanding of its own authority to intervene in constitutional disputes more generally. And so we might think that at heart there is a basic distinction about what degree should the court be telling us what the right constitutional answers are in some cases, and what degree other institutions ought to. And there's an interesting question in thinking about the 14th Amendment in particular, where the original meaning of Section 5 really suggests Congress ought to have a much greater authority than the court does in hashing out some of these contested questions. The other weird feature of Section 5, though, is also a federalism question, which Professor Sager emphasizes that state universities are a kind of democratic institution, that they're extensions of a state government. I find it difficult to think of state universities as being democratic, but nonetheless, go with that for a minute. But even if you think that's right, then it's still the case that these are state institutions in particular, and there's interesting questions about how deferential should we be about how state institutions interpret the 14th Amendment in particular, and what their duties are under that. And so even if we think we might want to be somewhat deferential to Congress for institutional reasons of various sorts, we might think less deferential to state institutions. So there's a lot of interesting layers of very important conceptual issues and normative issues at play in the kind of argument that Professor Sager raises. And you can imagine getting off that bus at any of those particular stops and getting to different conclusions. But yeah, I think it's a fascinating introduction, and I think it plays in nicely with a lot of other kinds of theoretical arguments that may or may not be more familiar to you, but lead you along a similar path.
Yeah, it's not clear we disagree, because one thing Keith was saying, there isn't a counter-majoritarian difficulty, that is to say some overwhelming difficulty, and I am pointing to a subset of cases which are very important, where perversely the courts, on my claim, the court should be most deferential, and where it has been least deferential. So we may not disagree about that. We may disagree about the structure of the construction zone, and you know, Keith is really famous for having introduced the distinction between interpretation and construction, I think. And that is, for Larry Solon, at least, it's a question of how much of the dictate comes from the Constitution read in the correct originalist modality, and how much of it is left over after originalism goes as far as it can go, which is often not very far. I'm content with that variation for folks who have that structure of thought, but you might not be an originalist, and you could be an originalist and agree with what I said. You might be someone quite opposed to originalism and still see a distinction between the extreme misbehavior of states that puts you in the categorical periphery and the discretionary strategic judgment. So there's that. I just want to note something. Keith raised the federalism question. There's something curious going on about all this, and that is in constitutional law, in panels like this, we tend to think that the court and things federal are where social justice comes from in this country. But if you had a 2x2 matrix that had court and legislature, state, federal, and state, with state meaning local, most social justice comes from legislative judgments by state and local governments. The federal government's judicial and otherwise interventions are in some ways restricted. They're very important, as with Title VII, but there's a huge amount of social justice activity that goes on at the state and local level at the hands of non-judicial entities. And that, on this account, that's not surprising, and it isn't to be deplored, it's to be applauded.
Any other, please?
I also have a question for Professor Sager. When you're talking about the affirmative action litigation that's pending at the Supreme Court, one case involves a state, another case involves a private institution, Harvard University. And do you see in the moral duty to effectuate the Equal Protection Clause, do you see a duty on behalf of private institutions as well? Now, one could say maybe Congress has delegated that duty through Title VI, but I'm just curious, to the extent that private institutions are engaging in affirmative action, are they fulfilling the core of the Equal Protection Clause?
Well, I think they are, actually. I mean, it's interesting, though, of course, because we've got these two cases there. The court's judgment is that Title VI and the Equal Protection Clause are essentially coterminous, and that puts the constitutional fat into the fire when we're looking at Harvard. But I'm not, you know, I need to think hard about this question. Certainly, certainly you could see, you could say the negative of Kara's question. That is to say, if Congress has appropriately legislated in Title VI to accomplish the amelioration of injustice on this account, Harvard buys into that obligation, even if it doesn't own that obligation natively. The reverse proposition, which is Tara's question, is more intriguing, which is, does Harvard have any special kind of claim here? And I don't know the answer exactly. I feel like I don't have to come up with it because you've got, because Harvard's towing the line constitutionally in the court's judgment. But this is a really intriguing question to which I need to worry more, about which I need to worry more.
Well, if I may, let me take a shot at least voicing maybe a contrary view, which is, if anything, isn't there an argument that Title VI speaks more explicitly against use of race than the Constitution? One can have a good faith originalist debate. Jonathan Mitchell has launched his theory on the 14th Amendment, but you know, you were talking earlier, Professor Sager, about the importance of a democratic opportunity here. Hasn't that already happened with Title VI? And if Congress wants to amend Title VI, it certainly can.
That's a question I think that we need a lot more material on the table for, and which the court has never really taken up. I mean, you know, Title VI was the basis on which four justices ruled in Bakke, right? And they said discrimination meant, you know, any distinction based on race, and whatever equal protection does, Title VI does this. If we came to the conclusion, you and I, or you and I, you know, if we came to firm conclusions about Title VI, that would be a democratic exercise, and would silence half of my objection to these cases.
If I recall, one of the four included Justice Stevens from the Bakke case.
Is that right? I didn't remember that. That's very interesting.
Yeah. I'm not saying he would do that today. I'm saying he did that in the 1970s. I think we have a question from the professor.
Judge, make them do it. There you go.
I've issued a mandate.
Thanks. Look, I'm Mike Grieve. I teach at Scalia Law, and I should sort of preface this by saying, or admitting, or confessing that in an earlier life, I ran the law firm that represented both Toni Morrison and Cheryl Hopwood. I don't want to fight. I just want to make sure I understand the argument, Larry, because I think it's very intriguing. This is the argument, your core argument, right, about imperfect moral duties. As I understand these cases, and for that matter, cases like Shelby County, City of Bernie, they all turn on the question of what exactly is remedial, right? So what they say is, you, legislatures, political bodies, have all kinds of discretion to do all kinds of things about these matters, provided that the measures you take are in fact remedial. And the civil remedies provision here in VAWA, that doesn't remedy anything, right? And the affirmative action programs, they don't remedy anything at all. So to what extent is it that your argument depends on sort of expanding either the notion of the underlying violation, right? How structural discrimination sort of gets extended over time and sort of still rattles through the system, or on the other hand, the notion of what exactly it is that constitutes remedial action as distinct from just creating new remedies or creating new rights, as Tony Kennedy said in City of Bernie.
Well,
thanks.
I'll take a quick pass at this. Katzenbach, of course, In Katzenbach, Justice Brennan argued for something more than merely a remedial power. He argued for the ability of Congress to have a different view of equal protection. And I actually agree with the outcome in Bernie and nothing else. And one of the things I disagree with in Bernie is the, I think, fairly bald misreading of Brennan in Katzenbach versus Morgan. And I think there were reasons that Brennan was right. Second thing is, putting all this on a remedial space, the case that comes to mind that is a model of thinking about this that ought to apply to Morrison is Jones versus Alfred Mayer, where the court does not assume the power to say that housing discrimination is a badge, incident, or relic of slavery, but concedes to Congress free judgment to decide what the badges, incidents, and relics of slavery are. I think by analogy, the argument in Morrison would be, if you look at the history of state-sponsored vulnerability of women to the violence of their husbands, you can trace contemporary violence against women and the epidemic that the country was facing at the time the Violence Against Women Act was first enacted, at least, if not still. It's fully attributable to regimes of unjust law against women, the way housing discrimination was attributable to as a relic of slavery. So if you see this as remediating structural injustice, that's fine. It's not a remedy to specific individuals for specific losses. It's a flaw, an ongoing flaw that the Constitution should despise, that Congress should have power to address. I don't know if that helps, but that's my sense of it.
Let me go back and forth, so we'll start over here.
Hello, my name is Jacob Snyder. I'm from the University of San Francisco. As a former history major, I was very impressed by Professor Rowe's wealth of knowledge about Brown v. Board of Education. And I'm wondering from your studies of that contemporary period, outside of explicit like judicial review for this decision, what other options would you say were available from someone with a Federalist perspective to take on desegregation during this time, besides just resigning themselves to the majoritarian discriminators, essentially?
So your question is, was there a way to deal with desegregation other than through the judiciary?
Essentially, if you're aware of, were there any other attempts to kind of deal with this?
So the major attempt happened in 1964 with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So Brown versus Board of Education, as many of you probably know, was decided in 1954. By 1964, fewer than 2% of all African-American children were in desegregated schools. So 10 years after the decision, it was pretty pathetic. That's what all deliberate speed meant. It meant not at all, essentially, which is actually what the states had advocated in Brown. So when Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Department of Justice got involved, the Department of Justice was much more effective in getting desegregation done. Federal courts got a little bit more bold, including the Supreme Court, but it was largely pushed by the federal government itself.
Interesting. Thank you.
So, Professor Sager, when I hear your remarks about the Equal Protection Clause, I sense you are sincere in searching the depths of your compassion and trying to understand how to best promote an equal and just society. And yet, for Asian Americans who feel that these admissions policies are discriminatory, that is perhaps all the more cause for horror, because you go to the sort of authorities who are supposed to be the ones who are most concerned about this issue, and you get a blank stare. And so actually to belong to a racial group that is so small and overlooked that actually these people implementing policies purportedly to eliminate discrimination are actually imposing harms that are being unnoticed and ignored. And so isn't that cause for even greater judicial intervention when it truly is such a small minority group that really they're just being overlooked and have kind of not even been discussed much in the court opinions or in the media?
You know, actually, that was discussed a lot in the briefs and in the lower courts. I think that there are serious potential objections to affirmative action, and the connection between affirmative action at Harvard and the admission of Japanese American students is a major version of that objection. I don't disagree at all. What I think is that, like Justice Thomas's concern with affirmative action, which is quite different, that these are what make affirmative action a very difficult, tortured policy with great advantages and disadvantages and trade-offs to be made. So I think this helps frame the claim that this is an imperfect constitutional obligation being discharged, and that it's that that should push the court away from wading into the controversy. Now, Keith said something quite true, which is you could get off the bus at various stops. You could accept the metaphorical structure of a discretionary core and a categorical periphery and say that where you have it wrong, Sager, is this objection to affirmative action at this place is in the categorical periphery. And that's essentially what you're saying. I don't think that's right, but I don't think there's anything in the structure of my remarks that adjudicates what might or might not be a disagreement between you and me. I think, and if, let me say this, if the court or any person were persuaded that this was in the categorical periphery, then it would indeed justify judicial intervention, as opposed to this painful set of trade-offs. Because the world, this much is true. We are, every time you turn on the television or read the newspaper or open your laptop and learn about another young man who's the victim of brutal violence at the hands of police in a traffic stop, you get a lot of evidence that structural injustice remains a grievous problem. And that means that ways of moving forward are vital, but they are very, very difficult. And this is a difficulty, and I don't want to brush it aside at all.
Please. Hi. Thanks for your commentary today. I'd just like to ask about Jonathan Mitchell's very provocative view regarding what he calls the writ of erasure fallacy, suggesting that when the court strikes down or voids or nullifies a law, that it really doesn't possess the veto power that we all are so used to thinking it does, and that actually the law remains valid on the books and capable of being enforced by future officials. Just curious as to whether any of the panelists are sympathetic to that viewpoint, that very provocative viewpoint of his. Thank you.
So I think that viewpoint suggests the contingency of judicial independence, right, and then the power of judicial decisions. So one can take the legal view that all a court does is decide the case or controversy before it, and that the impact of the case or controversy only applies to the parties before the court, something that, by the way, would be very problematic for nationwide injunctions, which are a separate point of controversy, right? Like, a court doesn't have the power to enjoin the federal government nationwide. It also would suggest that a court doesn't have the power to invalidate a federal regulation, that the language in the Administrative Procedure Act that says you can toss something out if it's arbitrary and capricious, you can't do that either. And the Solicitor General recently argued that to the Supreme Court, and they said, well, wait, we do that all the time. There are a lot of things that courts do all the time, and one of the things that people have assumed is that when courts declare something unconstitutional, it applies not just in that case, but applies writ broad, that's largely because that's the way the political branches have treated court decisions. So I think there's something to the argument. I think people should be aware of just how many implications that brings, and how important it is for the judiciary that the political branches listen to it. Now, if you don't like judicial decisions, then you probably don't want the political branches to listen to them. But if you care about judicial independence at all, if you care about judicial decision making, if you want any kind of judicial review, then you probably want the political branches to listen to the courts, not just in the particular case or controversy before them.
Although that level of description, I think it's clearly right, right? I mean, that from my perspective, I mean, if we think about what judicial review is, if we think about what judicial review is, it's simply a court saying, from our perspective, we can't constitutionally enforce that in this institution, right? That may have implications for how other courts are going to behave as well, and so there are big consequences to a court declaring that, especially if it's the U.S. Supreme Court that declares that. But it doesn't erase it from the statute book, so the court reverses its decision and thinks that that's no longer true, right? Then opens the doors and saying, oh, it turns out you can't enforce a statute that looks like that, and it turns out you got one still in the books, because, of course, you never repealed it after that point. So I think it's right in general, just as we think about what the structure of judicial review is. It's simply declaring what courts will or will not enforce or implement within their own institution, and that leaves a lot of wiggle room elsewhere, and including the potential that you say, well, that court told me no in that particular case, we're going to continue resisting it someplace else. As Professor Rove notes, right, that one thing we tend to take on board about how we want the process of judicial review works is we prefer in general that political actors don't press every one of those boundaries, because then the system itself sort of grinds to a halt and has a great deal of difficulty operating. There's some real downsides to acting like that all the time. On the other hand, you might think in some particularly important cases it's worth having that kind of battle.
Ultimately, I think Marshall's strongest argument in Marbury is the little old judge argument. He's doing what judges have always done. What's changed is the legal system has a new animal in it, which is constitutional law. And so an important question really is, what's the scope of what judges get to do? And judges not only have the power over parties before them, and a somewhat extraordinary power, on the whole, we think it's very important that they settle law and disputes of law for a variety of reasons. And that is a major part of what is at stake in the political response in this context. I want to note a peculiar quirk of our present situation, by the way, which is a variation on laws that live on. There are 30, I think something like 37 states which have constitutional provisions which define marriage as a covenant between a man and a woman. And those have non-trivial, expressive, and stigmatic consequences for the state in which they live. Federal courts can't touch those provisions because of the anti-commandeering doctrine, as I understand the NCAA case. The federal courts can't tell a state to change its laws. All they can do is they can enjoin the enforcement of those laws, and they can decline to enforce them. So those laws have a kind of an immunity from the reach of federal judicial process, which is a kind of odd consequence of a somewhat, to me, odd reading of the anti-commandeering doctrine. But it's pretty clear that's the court's view at this point.
They have an immunity relative to the symbolic aspect of the
yes,
laws, right?
Right.
Because it's also notable that this happens all the time in all kinds of contexts. So, for example, after the flag burning ruling from the Supreme right. Court, which says, right, you have a constitutional right to burn a flag, it's nonetheless true that cops all across the country continue to arrest people for burning flags and dragging them off to jail, and then, of course, no one actually enforces it, so then you let them go, right? But those laws still exist on the books. Police officers still behave as if they exist on the books. There's just no judicial ramifications of the fact that cops acted as if these are still law. Likewise, universities still have speech codes on the books, despite the fact courts say that's unconstitutional and we're not going to enforce them if you go here. And so universities think this is still very symbolically important, and we're going to try to avoid any litigation because it'd probably go bad for us if we actually got this in front of court all the time. So this is a very familiar sort of feature of what judicial review actually looks like in practice.
And I'm guessing there are people in this room even. I'm guessing there are people in this room, even those of you who were born post-1990, who had school prayer in your schools, even though the Supreme Court struck that down in the 1960s. Every year when I teach, some of my students had plenty of school prayer when they lived. And so I think the question is, if we want to treat court decisions that narrowly, what does that mean for our system writ large? Because it really reduces the power of the federal judiciary, which might be a good thing if you don't want federal judges doing very much. But for those who are cheering on recent federal decisions enjoining the federal executive nationwide from doing X, Y, and Z, this is not an approach to judicial review that you would want to adopt.
Was anyone born after 1990?
We stopped having birthdays.
These are
I wish you had not asked that question. The gentleman here.
Hello, Jonathan Ladd, University of Texas Law, friend of the program. So I have a question for Professor Sager. I'm trying to parse this concept of imperfect moral duties. Can the nature of this moral duty being center versus, at a boundary change just based on the way that you frame it? For example, you frame the concept of what a parent's not supposed to do versus what the parent's supposed to do, all of a sudden you have a core of things not allowed versus the outer boundaries of things that you can or cannot do. And if that is the case, how does that impact the way that we think about this concept of imperfect constitutional duties under your framework?
Well, it's probably easier to answer in the parental context. In some way, I want to insist that the essence of the duty requires judgment and discretion. It's not that there was a categorical core and it ran out. The heart of what needs to get done, in effect, is discretionary. And I want to offer this way of thinking about constitutional provisions, even those which enjoy robust judicial enforcement in the United States, like equal protection and free speech, in part because I think there may be very important democratic choices that get squished by the court's view of its role at the periphery, and moreover, the court's view that it gets to sort of decide what's core and what's periphery. And if Judge Ho will forgive me, in a jurist-centric environment like ours, there's a danger that courts will define constitutional meaning by reference to what they do and do best, as in negative prohibitory provisions, and that may starve us of constitutional possibilities. And all I'm asking, I'm a child of the Warren Court. I love courts. I've thought about courts for a long time. I want to insist that not that courts get displaced from their position, but that courts themselves recognize the boundaries of their preeminent role in things constitutional. I'm writing about this, and there's a phrase that came to mind. At one point I said, if hammers defined furniture, all the fasteners would be nails. And I thought it was funnier than it seems to be. and I worry that that judges in our system need to take a more generous view of constitutional meaning, and therefore a more bounded view of their dominating authority, even though I think they're critical where they're critical.
Thank you.
Professor?
Ilya Selman, George Mason University. I guess this is another question that arises from Professor Sager's key distinction relating to structural injustice. I think that, if I understand it correctly, that does a lot of the work in the argument, the difference between a structural injustice and perhaps some other kind of injustice which is not structural in nature, but it still seemed to me that maybe the concept need to be fleshed out more, because there is an argument which, you know, is actually made in these cases before the Supreme Court right now about affirmative action in higher education, that if you have lots of state universities all over the country systematically discriminate against Asians and whites and some other groups as well, that that is a structural injustice that's on a large scale. It's not just a harm to a few discrete individuals. And therefore, you could say this is something the court should strike down if the point of equal protection is to strike down state policies that engage in structural injustice. Now, you could say, and I would agree, it's not as big a structural injustice as Jim Crow was or other things of that sort. Or alternatively, you could say, we're not as certain that it really is unjust. Maybe it's okay if the purpose is to achieve a larger improvement in justice by compensating African Americans or perhaps other groups for, you know, their even greater historical injustice they've suffered. If disagreement about either scale or certainty can lift the possibility of judicial enforcement, then with the issue of scale, that would upend a lot of decisions, including many that not only I like, but people on the political left like Obergefell. That wasn't that, I think it was a genuine injustice that gays and lesbians couldn't get married in most states, but not anywhere near on the scale of Jim Crow or slavery or whatnot. And if there is and if the issue of disagreement about certainty is an issue, well, obviously today, quite rightly, we say there was a there was a grave injustice with Jim Crow, but at the time, the defenders had all sorts of reasons why it wasn't really unjust. They were just protecting their distinctive Southern way of life. They even said things like, you know, this is us protecting our culture against the domination of a now potential oppressive national majority and so forth. So how do we then separate out what is a what is a sufficiently clear and large structural injustice that courts can strike it down versus stuff that you would say, well, it's more disputable and therefore it's not at that periphery. And I think it seems to me that once you flesh those out, either you will probably have to accept that some things that you don't want to strike down should be struck down, or alternatively, you end up in a situation where some things that you probably think should have been struck down should not be. But perhaps you can flesh this out in a way that solves those problems. Thank you.
Certainly not going to flesh it out here, right? Look, if this structure is taken seriously, then questions like this will arise, and I would welcome them. I don't think that affirmative action in its most responsible and moderate forms really unseats this distinction. But if it turned out I was wrong, then I'd be wrong about those cases top to bottom and in whose hands judgment belongs. And we'd need to talk a lot about whether I'm wrong. There's nothing mechanical about this, and I won't be able to reduce it to a formula. It will be a claim about, it's a sociological claim, and we should talk about it, Ilya.
So my question was on judicial independence. It's clear that at least the Chief Justice feels that the court is seen as too partisan in terms of its actions. But when we look at like the court of the past, we used to have justices who are running for president without resigning from the bench. We used to have justices without law degrees or who hadn't practiced laws, my point is being that it seems like in some ways, and yet the court even back then could be very, very aggressive in utilizing its powers. Whether it's narrowly interpreting, you know, the Reconstruction Amendments and various activities. So I'm wondering, do you think this Justice Roberts framework of like courts being seen as too partisan is kind of, and that if we reduce that, then that would increase judicial independence and whatnot, is sort of in a wrong track considering the court used to even have senators and governors put on the bench and in the past has been still been very independent, very aggressive in pursuing its job.
So just to add one, Marbury versus Madison, John Marshall himself was the one that was that was supposed to deliver the commission at issue, and he issued the decision to the Supreme Court.
They weren't bound by a Supreme Court code of ethics either.
they weren't, and they didn't try. Marshall did a few things that were highly questionable. So I think your question is partly about judicial ethics. Should we have an ethics code for the Supreme Court? But I think your question also gets to the fact that the Supreme Court's always been somewhat political. I think there's no question about that. I think that anybody who thinks that the Supreme Court suddenly became political over the last couple of years has missed a whole bunch of our history. And it is a political institution, right? The justices are picked by the president. They're confirmed by the Senate. They handle a lot of cases that involve political issues. There's a lot of law there, too. I'm a firm believer that politics and law are very much enmeshed in the Supreme Court, and it's certainly done big things in the past. I don't think any of that is new. In fact, after recent decisions overturning Supreme Court precedent, I'm sure you can't think of anything. There's some studies done. Is the Supreme Court reversing precedent more than it did in the past? No, actually. There's a lot of focus on recent reversals, but the numbers are not that different from the past. What I was suggesting is the difference from the past is the degree of independence that our federal judiciary enjoyed from the mid-20th century until quite recently. In those earlier periods when the Supreme Court did stuff, there was actually a genuine threat that something bad might happen to the court, a threat that largely went away in the mid-20th century. There were some proposals for jurisdiction stripping in the mid to late 20th century, but no proposals to expand the Supreme Court, no proposals to obliterate a lower court, no proposals at all to disobey a Supreme Court judgment. President Nixon kind of threatened that a little bit during the Watergate proceedings, and other folks, including the vice president, said, don't do it because that will ensure you're impeached. As it turns out, with the tapes, he was going to be impeached anyway. But the reaction to him was very, very strong. You have to obey federal court orders. I think what we've had in more recent years is a much more independent federal judiciary. Now, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing kind of depends on your attitude toward what the judiciary has done. But I think that's the real change.
I think there are potentially multiple paths by which you get to judicial independence and that can reinforce judicial independence in general. One of those paths is potentially to claim that you're particularly nonpartisan, for people accept you as a relatively nonpartisan court. But there are probably other ways of getting there, too, where you can make other kind of pitches that don't turn on the nonpartisanship, per se, or the non-political aspect of it, per se. I do think the nonpartisan pitches, right, at odds with, and non-political, certainly, is at odds with what courts, in fact, look like across American history, and so not terribly sustainable as a general posture. But it's particularly not sustainable in our current political environment, right? And so I think part of what we're seeing at this level is the same kind of pressures of polarization that's affecting all kinds of institutions across the American system and is affecting the court in this context as well. So, for example, you can totally imagine that you have a court that's seen as fairly, is perceived as being fairly partisan. But the people who perceive it as being fairly partisan can't win elections, right? Or at least can't claim majorities very often. And as a consequence, can't do anything about it. Right, and that's been true through a lot of American history, where the electoral losers often also think the Supreme Court is behaving in a way that's political and partisan. Unfortunately for William Jennings Bryan, he kept losing elections, right? And that was true for populists, it's true for progressives, it's true for a lot of others across American history have done that. We're currently, though, in an environment in which we had dramatic polarization. The two parties have very different perceptions about what they want the Constitution to look like and what they want policy to look like, and as a consequence, very different perceptions about what they want the court to look like. They both, as a consequence, tend to think the court looks pretty partisan, favoring the other guys, and neither one has been able to claim a solid majority over time. If that situation changes, though, and somebody's willing to claim a real majority, that could be very bad news for the court. Right? So at the moment, I think the court is being saved a little bit by how tentative the majorities are. But I certainly think if we find ourselves in a situation in which you have a court constituted like our current court with similar instincts as our current court, and yet Democrats wind up with a very solid and predictable majority in ways they have not had for many decades now, you would get court packing.
I want to note one small thing about Justice Roberts, and that is, he had every right to dissent in Obergefell, but he had, it was a gross misjudgment to write the dissent that he wrote in Obergefell that essentially begins by saying, don't thank the Constitution, thank the five lawyers who voted for this outcome. As Chief Justice in a case with converging constitutional precedent, he owed the court more support than his dissent reflects. I think he wouldn't write that dissent in those terms today. And I want to make sure it's fine that he dissented, but not that he dissented in a way which, you know, spoke as directly as he could have to the legitimacy of his five companions. That was a mistake on his part.
Thank you.
We have run out of time. Please join me in thanking this wonderful panel.